Good evening. Feels like a very quiet evening here, and there's some new faces, so welcome. It's always really nice to see new faces. It's weird, the notes, I don't know, I guess it's my eyes that are shifting, but they're sort of, it's like just a little bit out of range. So that didn't used to be the case. Everything changes. So it was interesting. Last night I was doing a workshop, or not a workshop really, it was what we call a Dharma chat. So really kind of a chance to have an informal discussion with Shinryu Sensei. And we were talking about posture. And at one point, we were talking about the hara, which is the area in the navel that we really see as the seat or the source, in a way, of the body's energy. And when we're sitting, you know, we really, in a way, allow the breath to come from this place. This is sort of the home. And in Asian medicine, this area, in all Asian body philosophies, this area is really the seat of the body's energy. But Shinryu had brought up this very kind of interesting point, which I had never, you know, actually noticed before, that you can't actually physically locate this place. I mean, it's in this area, but there's nothing there that you could actually grab onto. There's nothing that you could actually take a hold of and extricate and say, this is the hara. And yet, so, in trying to discuss the Platform Sutra, that really emerged for me. Because, you know, in a sense, had a very similar experience, really, in reading this text. It's sort of like, as soon as you settle someplace and think, oh, so this is what he means by this, or oh, this is what this is. It's like by the end of the sentence or two sentences later, it's like you're magically catapulted like somewhere else across the universe. It's like everything this is becomes that, and everything that is somehow, in a way, shifts. I kind of had this image of a pancake constantly flipping from side to side, only in this text it also seems to be rotating and kind of flying around. So reading it is sort of this experience of non-abiding anywhere in and of itself. It's actually quite impossible to fix on any one idea and kind of hold on to it, much like the hara. So in this way, in a sense, it really is an enactment or a manifestation, really, of our Buddha nature or the Dharma itself. So, anyway, towards the latter part of this sutra, Huineng, who was the sixth ancestor in our Japanese lineage who wrote this sutra is kind of having a question and answer sessions with one of the priests or students at the monastery in which he's residing and teaching, and his name is Fa Ta. And Fa Ta says to him that he's been reciting the Lotus Sutra for 7 years, working and studying and reciting the Lotus Sutra for 7 years, but he still feels unclear and full of delusions. And he wanted to know, he asked him very sincerely, you know, he wants to know, so where does the true Dharma lay? You know, I've been reciting and studying the sutra for 7 years and I can't find it. So Poineng, who can't read, asks Fa Ta to recite it to him, which he does. And so we fast forward, because that could have taken God knows how long. But after hearing it once, he has a clear experience and understanding of it, and he responds to Fa Ta that, you know, while he was very proficient in the Dharma, not so much in his own mind. And it's kind of interesting because I think here he's sort of alluding to, you know, we get the sense that Fa Ta was maybe some kind of scholar, but certainly a researcher and somebody who really studied the Lotus Sutra for a long time. But in this act of reciting and studying, he was somehow seeing the Dharma as ideas, as external to himself, outside of his own mind. So he was kind of using his thinking mind, in a way, to understand and to make sense of this scripture that was going to give him the answers that he was looking for. But Huineng says to him, the mind has nothing to do with thinking, because its fundamental source is empty. So here we could say, you know, empty here as just not solid. You know, it's constantly shifting, moving, transforming. There's, again, like dhara, nothing we can hold on to. To discard false views is the one great causal event. To discard false views is the one great causal event. If within and without you are not deluded, then you are apart from duality. And he goes on and on and on. Again, it's Fa Ta's thinking here that is actually keeping him from having and being in touch with his own experience, his own innate wisdom, his own Buddha nature. In reading the Lotus Sutra, he's not experiencing the Lotus Sutra. He's trying to figure it out. So how often, God knows, do we do this? Really look everywhere but actually where we simply are and really miss what's right in front of us and what's right inside of us. I remembered this Peanuts cartoon that I loved as a kid. It's kind of a vague memory, but parts of it are very clear. And it was Linus, and it was a really early one because Linus was actually a baby. And Linus was in his crib, and he had his blanket, and he was wailing. He was screaming for his mother to come and take him outside of his crib, to let him out, to get him outside of the crib. And so he's wailing and wailing. And then slowly, all of a sudden, we notice that actually now he's like outside the crib. And he's wailing for his mother to come get him out of the crib. And then he's still wailing, but he's actually at the door. And still yelling for his mother to come get him out of the crib. And then we see him, he's like moving down this long hallway, and he's still screaming and yelling for his mother. And then he actually goes down, he's at the foot of a staircase, and he's screaming, and then it's like all of a sudden it sort of like stops mid-wail, and there's just this like realization of, I'm out of the crib. It's like, it takes until he's down the hall and down the stairs for him to just wake up to like where he is and what's happening. But it's like he was so caught up and stuck really in his story of being trapped. It's like he was just going to town. You know, I'm trapped, I need my mother, I'm alone, I can't get out. And he was so consumed with this story that actually he just couldn't be present to and see what was actually happening. So you could say in a way that this state of being so separated from ourselves and what is actually happening, because we're so caught up in our ideas and our notions about what is happening, what should be happening, what's not happening, what could be happening, what will happen, what did happen, and on and on and on and on and on, you could take your pick. This is what we call delusions and being in a dream. So it's like when we talk about just wake up now, it's like just, can we just come out of here and be here? But to have thoughts and ideas is just what the mind does. It generates them. Like grass or weeds is the common analogy given or metaphor used also for these delusions, just continuously. And as soon as we sit down on the cushion and we actually begin to quiet our minds enough to see what's happening, we can see, you know. I mean, they can be so many and so fast that it's like static in the radio, or, you know, it could be like flowing willows, or it's the wind, but it's just constant stream. The more we just quiet down, we can just begin to see the nature of our minds, just generating them. And and we practice not getting invested in them, you know, in our beginning meditation instruction. It's like, it's not like don't have a thought, or it's not push the thought away, it's just notice it and drop it and come back to your breath. Simple as that. Return, 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 return. See it, drop it, return. So again, the thing here is not that we're ever not going to have them, but we hopefully over time, and it takes a lifetime, practice with not being so attached and stuck to them that we actually don't even realize their thoughts. So this activity of no thought, or letting go of our ideas and views, is also ongoing, kind of like mowing the lawn or shaving. But we must look and see inside our own minds and at our own actions to practice this. You know, it's like this morning, I was just, this today, actually this whole day for me has been kind of like, it started this morning with interaction with the mechanics, and it sort of has continued all day. I was in a car accident last week. It wasn't bad, but this woman like just crashed into me from the rear. And like the bumper on the car became disattached. So what's sort of a minor thing, and actually it is a minor thing if you, when I stop and remember what actually could have happened, has just become this time-consuming, this just time sink hole, whatever. You know, and also they are paying ostensibly for a rental car while this is happening, which of course, though, I still have to pay for insurance for the rental car. So it's like, you know, so anyway, it was supposed to be done this morning and it wasn't, and the person wasn't there. And I mean, they were very nice, but the person who wasn't there, who was supposed to be there, it was someone else. And, you know, it was sort of like on like this, and after 20 minutes, you know, I had no information and it was just, and no car and what have you. And so I was, just kind of today, I was also going to fire a kiln. I had to write the talk. There were some other things going on. So I was actually just got myself into quite a state of rage at these poor people at the mechanics place, who actually, each one of them was being really nice and doing the best they could. And really, nothing terribly bad was happening. But I was just this feeling of, you know, rage and just pissed offness and irritation was just sort of escalating. And I just kind of was like, okay, let me just stop before I start driving. Let me just check in and see what's happening here. And I could just sort of feel in my body this sort of, you know, like, and I sort of just realized that actually this has nothing to do with that, and that I just was actually feeling kind of anxious and stressed today. And, you know, can I just be really thankful and hurtful that I wasn't hurt, that nobody else was hurt, that had this thing that I'm now feeling so inconvenienced by more, if she had been going 5 miles an hour more, you know, I'd be in the hospital, you know, pleading for it to only have been a disattached bumper. So it's like, could I just appreciate the fact that actually everything was fine? And that what was going on was something else entirely. So sometimes, you know, I think it's very hard for us to see what's actually even going on, you know, unless we see it somehow in relationship to something else. So it's kind of like I couldn't really see things as being fine until I kind of had what really would have been not fine, in a sense, to compare it to. And it took agitation about something else and being in that state to see, to just actually appreciate something working actually just harmoniously, in a sense. And it reminded me of something that Huineng also was talking about in regards to meditation, you know, where he was saying in, you know, that if we actually look for our mind and try to look for purity, if we try to look for emptiness, you know, not only will we not find anything, but then it's like we're creating a delusion, because then we're sort of making a thing out of what is not a thing. So, you know, it's kind of like actually through our delusions, really our difficulties, our mistakes, what have you, that we are actually afforded multiple opportunities in a way to drop our views to what's happening, to drop our attachments and our ideas, and to then simply be with and see reality as it is. So this activity of dropping and not knowing and seeing from that place is really our wisdom, in a sense, is our enlightenment, which we can't have if there was nothing to be enlightened from. And of course, this is actually all just another idea, but I'm really in the mud now. So something I've noticed working in the studio, which I always thought was sort of interesting, is that, you know, what keeps me working on something is like there's always something else to work out. Some of you may not know this, I'm a potter, so when I'm in the studio working, I'm working on ceramics. But it's like the piece isn't finished in a way until it seems like there's nothing left to resolve, or there's no more problems or, in a sense, issues to sort of work out and resolve. It's complete. At that point, anything I do to it, in a way, will just be extra, or will be to mess up, in a sense, what's always working. And often the hardest thing, I think, and probably I know another artist in the room, that one of the hardest things is knowing when to stop, to like not then mess up what's already there and fine. But at that point, in a way, the piece is done. And it's interesting because there is this tremendous feeling sometimes, which is often fleeting, of a kind of completeness or satisfaction, and almost maybe even for really a moment, a quality of bliss when it's just, okay, it's happened, it's there, it's done. But that's really just a moment. And then before you even know it, what you're interested in and is working on the next piece. And it's almost like when something is completely done and working, I almost don't even see it anymore, you know? It's almost because there is a harmony there, you can't even break things apart to see what's going on. There's nothing to see anymore in that way, to break apart and to see. So it's actually, in a way, when the pieces are not really working or are not, in a sense, quite in harmony and in relationship, that all the learning and the exploring and, in a sense, the activity is happening. So again, you know, it's kind of an interesting phenomena that he says to us, that we cannot speak of viewing the mind and of viewing purity or emptiness, which is what we think we're so desperately looking for, because its nature of its very self is constantly changing and shifting and moving, almost dropping our attachments as they arise. And when we're in the midst of this just experience of sounds, sensations arising, dissolving, there's no one there viewing. There's no one to make the report to ourselves or to anyone else. There's no one there. But he says to be attached to that is not it either. Because we can't stay here. You know, in this space, there's no functioning. So we can't totally reside in that place and function in the world. And he reminds us that thoughts and actions are actually the functioning of reality. So this is the sphere in which we actively live our lives. And, you know, with that in mind, we will just always and forever be making mistakes and also committing evil actions, you know, as we live our lives. You know, I was having some pretty bad thoughts about a number of people today for any number of reasons. And in a sense, you know, this is our karma. We each have all of our own patterns, our habits, and our mental tracks, so to speak, of conditioning that are going to constantly be inflecting and shading whatever our ideas and views are, which are constantly emerging. And those will likely be very unique to us. Some may be universal, some will be unique, but we are responsible for seeing them and tending to them and dropping them. So we practice being present to what is in front of us and inside of us continuously and vigilantly. You know, as day becomes night, and just the way the sun and the moon continuously rise and set. So do our delusions. And our dropping. So I need to wrap up here, but as Thuy Nhang says, we can see our meditation is the lamp and wisdom, our wisdom is the light generated by this lamp. So we use this quality of light, this penetrating, really exquisite light that is different from our ordinary, regular mind. It's different from our thinking mind. It's our no-thinking mind. So we use this light to see whatever it is that needs to be seen, liberating and discarding all our false views to see what's in front of our eyes and what we need to do.